This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montaigne. The most popular piece of technology in China is the cell phone. 600 million people there have one. That's twice the population of the U.S. and three times the number of Chinese with internet access. They can be found among the nation's wealthiest and its poorest, but cell phones aren't talking to one another. They're text messaging. NPR's Laura Seidel reports on how this form of communication is woven into every aspect of daily life, from the political to the comic to the deeply personal.
If Romeo and Juliet lived in modern China, their dialogue would probably be in 70-character text messages. That's how Wang Lei's boyfriend courted her. He texted her about his childhood, his college life, and his parents.
All sent text messages to me.
He told you all these things about his growing up in a text message.
Yes, yes.
Unfortunately, this relationship ended as it began, with a text message.
He just sent a text message to me that he said he was not sure about a lot of things. So I understand what he means. So, okay, I said, Let's be strangers, and I said, we wave goodbye, and I came here.
Wang, a college student, is here in Beijing visiting a friend to get over the heartache.
It's very sad to break up with somebody with a little text message.
And that boy is a little bit shy, and I think this text message is maybe the best way for him to say something to me.
Text messaging really is the best way to say something to her, says Alvin Graylin, the CEO of MInfo, a mobile search company based in Shanghai.
Chinese are a little more indirect. They don't like to always say what they really mean, or they don't say all of what they really mean. And it's easier to sometimes communicate through a short message, a small communication of what you're looking for, than to call somebody and have to explain everything.
Graylin says traditionally the Chinese have a hard time expressing deeply personal emotions. A text message allows them to do it without bumping up against old cultural norms. There are other reasons why text messaging is so popular in China. Text messages are cheaper than a phone call by about half. No one in China has voicemail, so it's the best way to make sure someone gets a message. These days, everything from marriage proposals to business transactions are being done with text messages. Here's how it works with Chinese characters. Most people install a software that uses English letters to represent the sound of particular characters. And if you can't find the right characters, you can probably find someone else to do it for you. Peng Fei Dai is probably China's most well-known text message poet. For a small price, you can buy one of Peng Fei's love poems, like this one. If I send you the message, I love you, then save it or delete it. I just hope that you don't forward the message on to anyone else, especially not your mama and papa. Writing poems and jokes for text messages isn't a full-time profession for Peng Fei. He also writes plays, satirical journalism, and fiction. But he feels like when he writes text messages, it reaches more people. So far, text messaging is also beyond the reach of China's infamous government censors. Internet dissident Yu Jia says activists use text messages to organize protests. Yu says earlier in the year, there were plans to build a polluting oil refinery in the southeast of China. Local people used text messages to organize a huge protest, and they stopped the refinery. The censors take down Yu's online writings because he is critical of the government, but he says he often receives uncensored text messages critical of the regime. Yu says he receives a lot of sarcastic jokes about corruption and government efficiency. He says a lot of the time these jokes, even though they are authored anonymously, are written better than anything done by China's most well-known authors. Yu believes that scholars of Chinese history who really want to know about the best literature of this time will have to find a way to research its text messages. Laura Seidel, NPR News.
Now to viewing habits. Keeping track of who watches what on television has been going on since TV networks began broadcasting. And for years, the Nielsen Company held a monopoly on that TV ratings business. Now with hundreds of channels to choose from and various ways to watch the programming, the business of monitoring viewership is in a state of upheaval. NPR's Kim Masters reports.
For many decades, it seemed that Nielsen pretty much ruled the media world. Television shows lived or died by the ratings, which advertisers used to decide where to run their commercials. Of course, there were only three big networks in those days, which made it a lot easier for advertisers to get their taglines and jingles into the national consciousness.
Where's the beef? Hey, where's the beef?
He likes it. Hey, Mikey.
Flop, flop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Nielsen enjoys such a monopoly that it didn't necessarily worry about whether its customers, that is, advertisers and television networks, were particularly happy with the company's services. But thanks to the digital revolution, Nielsen has had to rethink everything. Susan Whiting runs the ratings service.
We really have changed our view of the world.
In the past couple of years, she says, Nielsen has branched out to measure viewership across three screens, as the company puts it. Television, the internet, and cell phones.
A lot of the research we're doing, it'll be the first time someone's looking at an area or an issue.
That's all well and good, says Tracy Shapak. She's with Starcom, an agency that advises advertisers on how to reach customers. Nielsen may need to measure viewership on new screens, she says, but the company hasn't even kept up with the original screen, still the most important one, and that would be television. Nielsen still determines ratings by tracking only about 12,000 households, she says, and that isn't nearly enough at a time when many homes have more than 300 channels. In fact, she says, Nielsen's small sample may be the reason your favorite show went off the air.
There are programs that are being canceled because the panel really is not large enough to tell the true desires of the U.S. population in terms of programming.
A customer like Shapak is not likely to stay loyal to Nielsen at a time when advertisers have a much better tool than the ratings. CBS executive David Poltrack says the key to the future is that set-top box that's probably already in your home. It keeps track of everything.
Now, instead of relying on a Nielsen sample, you'll be able to say, of the million households in this cable system, 400,000 of them were watching this program.
And that's not all. It's possible to take the data from your box and match it up with information about what you bought at the grocery store when you swiped your shopper card to get 6 cents off that bar of soap. And then, Shapak says, advertisers won't have to guess whether their commercials work.
What that allows you to do is say, did you buy my product after watching my ad? And that gets to the holy grail of measurement, because I can tell a dollar invested in television, does it pay off? What is my return on investment?
In theory, advertisers won't be able to identify consumers by name.
All they know is household 123 bought Skippy and watched American Idol.
This kind of information is becoming available even as we speak. And where does that leave Nielsen? The cable and satellite companies control those set-top boxes and the information inside.
So it's the first time in decades that we've seen competition in television audience measurement. Competition is necessary to drive innovation, which has been lacking from this space for decades.
Tracy Shapak says all sorts of competitors are getting into the game, TNS and TRA, or Google. It's a stiff challenge for Nielsen, but not necessarily one that the company can't overcome. A top executive at one of the big four networks thinks Nielsen will do just fine. I hate them, he says with a sigh, but what can I do? His company only has so much money to spend on research, and Nielsen is still the industry standard. Getting the networks and advertisers to change? He doesn't see that happening anytime soon. In the midst of the revolution, Nielsen's best friend may be inertia. Kim Masters, NPR News.
All right. Scientists have discovered the epicenter of internet Ludditism. Its IP address is 143.228.144.186. You may know it as the U.S. House of Representatives. The hallowed halls of Congress are a collection of tubes, I believe one lawmaker explained, but now the tubes are clogged. Andrew Noyes is a reporter at Congress Daily, the author of the tech blog, the Tech Daily Dose blog. Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Hey, good. I'm glad you were able to get a series of tubes plugged in there.
Yeah, of course.
That's one of my favorites.
It's like Congress and the internet. You got to go to the fine senator from Alaska, Mr. Ted Stevens. So we know Congress is a little backwards. If you email many congressmen, you get this form letter saying we don't accept email. They're kind of scared of it. But there are two congressmen who have been Twittering. What's the problem with that?
Well, the problem with that is, by some folks' estimation, that they're breaking the rules of the House of Representatives. there's a proposal currently in the works that would actually regulate how members of Congress post videos on the web. So twittering and blogging and all of that stuff actually isn't the focus of this early proposal, although the congressman backing this plan has said that he's going to address that when the time comes.
I think, is it the case that technically, you know, doing any sort of blog post or YouTube post or a Twitter post that's not on the official website of Congress, where I just read the IP address, that's illegal technically?
That's not illegal, but it's against the House rules, as you all were describing earlier, you know, the company handbook, if you will.
Okay, and so what happened? Someone said, well, let's test these rules. Someone said, let's reform these rules. Who's behind trying to change or rethink the rules?
Sure. Basically what happened is about a year ago, Speaker Nancy Pelosi asked Representative Michael Capuano from Massachusetts to head up this Commission on Mailing Standards, which is also known as the Franking Commission, to take a look at revising the rules surrounding how members communicate with their constituents. The Franking Commission was originally intended to guide them on how they use the free postage with snail mail,
mm-hmm.
if we remember the good old days there. But now they're looking at using this commission to revamp the rules in the internet age. Congress, you can criticize Congress all you want for being late to the game on a lot of things, but you know, I think Capuano, from what he tells me, we spoke at length yesterday. He's trying to do a good thing here. In his words, he's just he's trying to make it easier, really, for members to communicate without tarnishing the reputation and the integrity of the chamber, which is what he thinks could be done if folks are twittering and blogging and posting videos on websites that have commercial or political advertising.
So if
that's really where the big problem is.
Right, but if Capuano is trying to lead an effort to reform things so that they can get some more online and internet communication, why is Republican Minority Leader Boehner framing it as an assault on free speech?
Sure, yeah, he did call it an attack on free speech. He sent out widely an internet free speech threat memo to the blogosphere, and that's really whipped up quite a frenzy. He just believes that members should be free to post really what they want, where they want it, in the spirit of communicating with their constituents. And I guess on a larger level, you really can't argue with that. But he just thinks that Capuano is taking the wrong approach here.
So does he say, yeah, we know the rule, let's just ignore the rule? He doesn't really want the rule to be rethought?
Well,
Boehner?
That's not entirely true. There are several Republicans on Capuano's commission, Vern Ellers from Michigan, Kevin McCarthy from California, and Tom Price from Georgia, who've altered an alternative to the chairman of the House Administration Committee that will really have the final say, which they think is a better proposal. It would essentially let members keep posting content at the sites of their choosing, but they also recommend that a disclaimer could be created to alleviate concerns regarding the implied endorsement by the House of any commercial site where the member's content appears.
So tell me about the two twittering congressmen. Are they really twittering? Because sometimes in Congress they say, oh, we have a blog, and it's just like that day's press release gussied up like a blog. So tell me about the twitterers.
These guys are the real deal. It's Representative John Culberson from Texas, who's a Republican, and Timothy Ryan from Ohio, he's a Democrat. They have been twittering all over the place. They've been twittering back and forth, engaging one another in debates over politics and policy. Culberson routinely blogs from the halls of Congress, from the floor of the House, wherever he's got his cell phone, he can do it. And he's really kind of a renegade in this space, and he's becoming the poster child for a lot of bloggers who are encouraging more transparent processes on Capitol Hill.
See, I know what's going on. The rest of Congress is very worried that they're going to have to be held to 140 characters.
Right.
They're nervous. Now, in all honesty, is it a bit of a generation clash? I did the research. The average age in the House is 55, and in the Senate it's 60.4. That's the average age. And even if corporations are run by guys in their 60s, there's usually a bunch of powerful people in their 30s and 40s. It's just not the case with Congress. Is that largely a reason for the disconnect?
Well, I think that forward-thinking, tech-savvy congressmen are the exception, not the rule. But you do have members like Senator Patrick Leahy, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's been all over technology. Every new development, he really pays attention to. You've got Representative Rick Boucher, a Democrat from Virginia. He's one of the most tech-savvy guys I know. Both of them aren't exactly spring chickens, but I think, as generally speaking, I think that Congress. Members of Congress really don't want to have to deal with all of these new technologies, these new platforms. But I think members like Culberson and Ryan have really found a way to embrace these new technologies and reach out to their constituents in a new way.
Andrew Noyes, reporter at Congress Daily, the author of Tech Daily Dose blog. Thank you, Andrew.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up on the show, checking in with a woman who was recently living in a FEMA trailer. This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.